Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. Today, we're heading to the homeland of Montreal to chat with two of my favorite people, Vanya and Marc Olivier, and their restaurant, Vin Mon Lapin. We talk about how they got their start in the local culinary scene, how they met, what one could expect when they visit the restaurant, and what it means to be the number one spot in Canada. It was a great conversation, and I cannot wait to go visit them again in the city that I love. And then it's a live performance from Sander Urians, whose new album, Phantom Limb, is out on his own imprint, Ghost Talk Records. We chat about the holiday season, his approach to writing songs for his own album versus scoring incredible shows and movies like Ozark and Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and also him entering a song into the LA and New York song canon. It's an all-new episode just for you here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
It's a ritual, sacrifice. Behind the veil, illusion lies. Minds bleed from the sharpest lies. Before you're born, before you can choose, you're stripped of worth. Nothing to win, everything to lose. It's a ritual, it's a sacrifice. It's a
sacrifice.
Vanya and Marco, two of my favorite people from Montreal. So good to see your faces. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I know it's a busy time of year, so thanks for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're excited to see you too.
Look, Montreal's one of my homes. Dad's from there. And, you know, I am familiar with the food scene, but not as intimately as you two. And I do consider yourself like being young, but still two veterans of like sort of like the modern scene. It's so much has changed over the years, and even from like when I started going up and when I met you guys. But what do you remember from when you got started to something now that's still the same, that you still love, that keeps you in the game?
What a good question. You know, I think that's kind of what we all love about the restaurant scene anywhere. You know, like I was just in Italy and the espresso is still €1 after all the years. Like I love holding on to those things. So places, for example, in Montreal, like full of nostalgia, like L'Express or like Wilensky's, places like that, that are still
Schwartz's.
Still exactly the same, haven't changed. Like, you know, I mean, they might have painted a wall, but I haven't noticed. Like, nothing has really evolved from the first ever time that we stepped foot in there. So those places, I mean, with Marco, like our rotation is really filled with those classics. Like that's really what we love to keep going back to, just because, yeah, there's something so comforting about it.
Yeah, I mean, there is such a comfort of going back into the city. And I mean, there's been such a culinary spotlight on the city itself. I mean, the last 10, 15, 20 years has really, I think, brought Montreal into so much more of the global conversation. And you talk about these old spots that are like just part of the fabric. So what do people, maybe outsiders, sometimes misunderstand about the city?
Wow, those are deep questions there. And you know, one thing that we get told a lot, and like it's something that you really have to be from outside of the city to notice, because we have in us, I feel like a big part of it is the joie de vivre and the hospitality that you find in restaurants in Montreal. Of course, the food, of course, all the you know, the now famous generous portions and the foie gras and all of that. But sorry, what I find is really special in Montreal is how people are used to go to restaurants and the diversity of restaurants that we have here. I find that makes Montreal a bit special.
You know what I love? I love that everything is packed until like 1 a.m. And I take that for granted all the time. And whenever I travel outside, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's not necessarily a given. Like, thing everywhere, right? I love that you walk into, you know, any bistro or wine bar or whatever, and that on a Monday, you know, at like 11:30, it's just like you still have to line up to get a seat.
It's definitely something we take for granted, especially I was in Washington, D.C. last weekend. Mm-hmm. My friend is like an MMA fighter, and I went to see him fight.
Sure.
Man, we struggled to get some food at midnight after the fight. We were like really trying hard.
Oh, but yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely in our culture here. Like we eat much later than most places in North America. And like, you know, people love to go to restaurants and people love to splurge in restaurants.
Was it that energy that like built in restaurant culture that pulled you in to working in the industry in the first place?
Oh my God. At first I just wanted to cook, right? Like mm-hmm. I didn't want to be a chef. I didn't want to own, like, I thought that would be nice if that happened right. at one point, but I really just like started cooking just because I liked cooking. I didn't know at the beginning, I didn't know if I liked to do it on a professional way. I just wanted to like learn some stuff, and I got hooked. I never thought of doing anything else. It's never crossed my mind. And it's been 20 years now that just going, you know, I haven't really even, maybe it's the first time I stopped thinking of why I'm doing this right now with your question. You know, I love it. I have it in me.
But you're right, Darren, though. There's something really special about being part of that community, you know, like, contributing. So same, you know, getting into the industry here specifically in Montreal was, it really is kind of like a vacuum in a way, because you're all of a sudden, just a tiny drop in a bucket in this amazing community that we have, but you really do feel the result, because the clientele, mm-hmm. local and international, mm-hmm. is so blown mm-hmm. away by that sense of Montreal hospitality. It really is special. Like, it really is something that I haven't seen or experienced elsewhere.
I mean, I'll never forget when I came up for my bachelor party, the first meal we have was at Joe Beef that Thursday night, and the way that you took care of, we sort of knew each other, but not crazy well. And I just felt like I'd known you for years, and you know, that love and that extension is, you do take it for granted. You do be like, you go to other cities and you're like, okay, like the food's here, but it's missing a little bit of that love and that family feeling. Sure. You guys have the industry to thank of bringing you two together, right? You guys met in the industry.
Exactly. We were work colleagues before anything else.
I feel like that's a good, like, if you can work with someone and you respect someone the way they work, that allows for like friendship and more.
Totally. Yeah. We were the best of friends. Tons of respect, obviously. And then things just evolved, you know, as life can do to two people.
Yeah. 15 years now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, listen, you two were working at some of the most decadent restaurants during some of the, like, the headiest times in the Montreal scene. You know, that was the reputation coming out.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, obviously things has changed, and I want to talk about that change a little bit, but during that era and like the late aughts and things like that, like, what was it like, you know, the good, the bad, unbelievable, you know, like, you talk about being part of a community, but that was a community with legs.
Yeah, for sure. It wasn't for the faint of heart, and there was mm-mm. something really excess driven about it. You know, in all of those moments, for sure, even when you're in it, there's something very unsustainable, you know, about that type of energy. It's kind of like a perfect storm of everyone being the right age at the right place in their life, with the right conditions, where they're all in the same zone and with those same desires to kind of go crazy. So I just remember there are so many times where I remember thinking, I wish everybody who loves food and wine and, you know, all these things could be here. Mm-hmm. I remember moments that, like, I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, like, I just really wish everybody who would appreciate this could be here, because these are such fleeting moments.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, whatever it is, like, you know, scenes like the hockey scene with Bourdain on Valentine's Day with, like, the immense sauerkraut, like, things like that where, like, yeah, you're living it, but you're also just like, this is never going to happen again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I mean, we were super lucky to be along for the ride during those crazy moments.
And it felt like the cooking at that time, the food, was just pushing boundaries in a way where there's a little bit more maybe restraint or refinement today. Mm. Marco, what was it like being in the kitchen at those times and just pushing boundaries?
We talked earlier about, like, iconic Montreal restaurants like Walensky's and, sure, you know, Moishe's was part of that.
Steakhouse, yeah.
Yeah, steakhouse. But there was, like, this moment of all these, you know, real institutions that were open 80 plus years ago. And then 20, 25 years ago, Pied de Cochon opened in Montreal, yeah, which was really, I feel, the start of a new genre and a new style of cooking in Montreal, where Martin and, like, what he was doing, I think it's 22 years now that Pied de Cochon opened, really influenced a lot the Montreal food scene, to a point that a lot of restaurants were influenced or, like, wanted the piece of the pie almost, you know, like, and that lasted quite a bit. That lasted a good, that type of food, that type of generosity, that type of opulence, Pied de Cochon style, influenced a lot of restaurants in the city. And even if you go to Pied de Cochon now, it's evolved into less of that, you know, like, mm-hmm, there was really a time and place for that. I remember going to cooking school. My one of my first jobs in Montreal was Joe Beef. Then I stayed for 11 years, I think. You're out of cooking school. I've worked in a few Michelin star places in Europe where everything's kind of, like, you know, clean and twizzery and, like, whatever. Like, at that point, Molecular was super.
Yeah,
was,
yeah. Was, oh, man.
Like, Molecular was big, you know, like, if everybody wanted. I was like, yeah, in cooking school, they're teaching you how to make, like, soy spaghetti and, like, caramelized onion spheres. And then.
Spherification.
Yeah, I remember. And then remember my first day at Joe Beef. It's like, the rib steak is 36 ounces and it serves with a quarter pound of fatty smoked meat and foie gras and pickles. And I'm like, oh, that's also, like, that's very different. But I was really into it. You know, I was 19 years old. So I was a sponge at that time. I was ready to learn everything and meet everybody and work even more and, you know, and fuck up and, like, order whole pigs and learn from scratch and, like, do all that stuff. And, at that moment, and for, like, a very long time, that's really what I loved cooking. That's really what I loved serving. It was so much fun. People at the restaurant always make fun of me. I still do that, but I would, like, you know, I'm not a guy that goes in the dining room a lot. It's not my favorite thing. But I love to watch people eat. So I would, like, you know,
yeah,
like,
those
moments where not every, you're cooking off the cuff a bit, you're cooking in the heat of the service, and you know what you're doing is good, but you didn't, like, test it a million times during the day. And, like, so I would, like, hide behind the pass and kind of, like, look in the dining room at Joby, if it'd be the bar back in the day, ABCD.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Wait for that one first bite and wait for that reaction kind of thing. Yeah, that was, you know, and, like, the wow factor of, like, you know, bringing a whole pork shank with an oyster sauce, like, you know, like, it was already, like, a big wow factor in every aspect, you know?
Yeah, that enjoyment, that decadence.
There's also, Darren, like, you have to remember, this is all pre-Instagram stuff, right?
No, I know. It was all, it was such a mystery. You just heard.
Exactly. There was a huge mystery. Yeah. Nobody had any idea what it was going to really be.
And Twitter existed, but, like, we didn't have Twitter at that time.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it wasn't even really used by the masses. And it was not photography, so you really had to use your imagination. And when you entered, you know, things were just like a discovery, right?
I miss that.
People didn't know what they were getting into, exactly. You know? Like, now it's very different. I enjoy the moment we're cooking in right now very much, but that aspect has almost completely disappeared. Everything has been geotag and Google image and, like, Eater 38 and Yelp and everything. So people know, first, kind of like already know what they want to eat, know what it's supposed to look like, know the weather to ask for. You know, there's a bit that's changed a bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to keep people on their toes. We change the menu all the time, so that doesn't happen too much.
And yeah, you have a daily menu and that does change, but I have heard things where people just show up to restaurants, literally hold up a phone and just be like this and point. Yeah. No one can see it, but we're all doing the same move. all right, let's take a quick musical break. When I come back, I want to talk about a shift in the scene and the road to opening Vin Mon Lapin and what people can expect to hear on the stereo late at night on, let's say, like a Tuesday. I'll give you time to think about it. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Darling, I was your safety home. There was no better call to make. I could have been. But you always want what you cannot have. You push me away just to beg for me back. No, 'cause you always want what you cannot have. You push me away just to beg for me back. And darling, I'm here for you. I could be here for you. We could be more than friends. There could be more to this.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Vanya and Marco from Vin Mon Lapin. And right before the break, we were talking about a shift from sort of the old guard with Au Pied de Cachan, and then the wave that came after that. But then I felt there was another shift. I felt like maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, people sort of sobered up, both figuratively and literally. People started looking at a different type of cooking. What was it like to be in the scene when that, I don't know if healthier is the right word, but like there was a groundswell of being like, we can't keep, as I think Vani said, this isn't sustainable.
Well, right. So totally. I think also though, like we just personally got older.
Yeah.
And like anything, you know, you want to live through, you know, different phases and you know, go through different things, go to bed at different hours, you know, fill your days differently. So that's kind of what it is.
Also, our clientele kind of like gets older with us a little bit,
well,
you know?
Yeah. Mean, and then, exactly.
Yes and no, but, you know.
But, and I want to just be really clear when you talk about shifts, like Au Pied de Cachan is still open and incredible.
Of course.
It's still open and incredible. Au Pied de Cachan was open. The Sugar Shack is probably one of my favorite places in the world.
Sure. Legendary.
To go to. Legendary. I make it a yearly pilgrimage at least once a year. So
weirdly, their summer menu.
Oh my God.
Their summer menu that what Vaison cooks out there is incredible.
But it's not every night. It's not every day like it used to be.
Exactly. And there are a lot less, you know, brown booze shots circulating and things like that. It's more about like, you know, a little bit more elegance.
I'm like, okay, if I don't drink another shot of Jameson for like the rest of my life.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly. Yeah.
We've moved forward.
Macallan 12 only for the show.
Yeah, only. You see, we're moving up. 18.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, 18. Yeah. I'm so sorry. I forgot who I was talking to.
Oh my God.
But yeah, the shift comes, right? You have a different way that you want to cook, you want to live, and the food that you want to serve. Was that shift, that stuff, was what started you on the road to thinking about opening up your own spot? When did you start having those conversations?
Honestly, we didn't. Like, we really didn't have conversations that were like, okay, we're evolving, blah, blah, blah. Like, because you don't notice it, right? It just kind of happens organically. To us, so we live in Little Italy in Montreal, which is the same neighborhood where you can find the Jean Talon Market, which is the really best in North America, like aside from, let's say, maybe the West Hollywood Farmers Market, which is mind-blowing. It's probably one of the best markets, you know, in the continent, just because it's open every day of the year. Huge, you know, covered portion, also outdoors in the summertime. Really special. So it's one of our favorite places. We live about 2 blocks from there. We're always walking around the neighborhood with our dog. We saw this place for rent. We started having, you know, some dreamy thoughts because we just spent the last 15 years on 1 block on Notre Dame having the best time. But, you know, we were excited to maybe branch out and do something else. So so we decided to invest in our neighborhood that we love. Mm. It's literally at the opposite side of town. And what's funny is that Joe Beef and those restaurants are by the other market in Montreal. The
Apple. Sure.
So it's the tale of two markets, essentially.
I love
it. So we started dreaming about what it would be. We already had, at the time, we were all still kind of partners and doing all the restaurants together. So we already had the Joe Beef, you know, big, burly, meat heavy, etc., oysters, whatever, restaurant. We had the Liverpool House Bistro. We had the Vin Patrio Natural Wine Bar. So we were like, okay, what are we going to do? And it just became obvious that we wanted to do something really intimate, really connected to kind of Marco's background, cooking lots of Italian-inspired food. Jessica's background, who's our co-chef and partner, cooking a lot of really exciting vegetables. And that's it. Wine was a big part of it from the start.
Personally, we wanted to really open, like we wanted to work in this neighborhood. We wanted to work in Little Italy.
Yeah.
But also, I wanted to cook again. Mm. You know, like, At one point, I started garde-manger and then, you know, become chef and then chef of
chef
and then executive chef. And then all of a sudden there's 130 employees. And then me being the line in cooking, wasn't a, like meant something went wrong, you know, like it wasn't, it for a few years, me cooking on the line, it wasn't the plan anymore. Cause I had all these other things to do.
Right.
Opening Mont Lapin near where we live in their neighborhood that we love so much. We lived there together for a long time. For me, meant cooking again. And I was really, really excited because I became chef and executive chef. I don't regret anything, but kind of young. I'm happy it happened, but
I could still do this. I can still be on the line. Yeah.
I still want to. Exactly. Let me in. And I was like, it can't be that I'm like the executive chef that doesn't cook on the line anymore at 29. And then that's it, you know, like it was really important for me to get back in the kitchen, get my hands dirty again with Jess. Really important to bring Jess in this project. And then it kind of like re-sparked something in me that it wasn't not there, but I was like scared that it could maybe disappear a bit too early. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. No, I get that. You still want to be able to have a tactile feel to create instead of just being like, I have ideas or someone else is executing my vision. You know, you mentioned Jess, and you know, you have five partners who are opening, and I've seen this as a trend now where it's not just one chef with maybe like private equity or something like that. Like I've seen these like multiple partner operations. Why did you want to take that approach for this restaurant, given that it's expanded over the years, but it's still pretty small and intimate? What was the structure like and why that approach?
It was very clear. There's enough room in a busy restaurant than one owner and one chef and one sommelier. There's, you know, we really had like a solid core of people that we wanted not to hire. We wanted to work with, which is like, just like if we want to make that clear, because it's the way we plan the business, is the way we like wanted to like manage the restaurant. So we don't want to work with, we want to hire these people, want to work together. And like work together means at all levels, you know, and there's running many restaurants for many years. I realized quickly that when you're busy, if you want to keep everybody kind of with some, what's the word? Like
Inspiration, motivation,
you know, energy even, you need to work a bit less. And to work a bit less, you need to be able to split the work. There's enough work in a busy restaurant for two chefs. There's enough work for two managers. There's enough work for two sommeliers. If you have an okay-sized restaurant that's busy and, like, you know, you keep the love of your work doing it like that, then that's what we wanted to create at Mont Lapin.
I mean, that's... it's a beautiful thing. I've never heard that approach that way, to understand that like there's enough room for everyone and not just one.
And like we make sometimes we're like, oh, maybe in February we're a bit too many people here, but we make it like we
when it gets cold outside and everyone's inside trying to stay warm. Yeah.
We make it work and we find the work, you know.
Yeah, I mean, look, speaking of the restaurant itself and having this type of ethos, it really is reflected in the food and the wine you source, but also the design. And it's got a lot of local art. It feels like the perfect type of neighborhood restaurant. What went into building out the space? How conscious was it to put everything together so it feels and has that type of vibe?
That was the idea. I mean, you nailed it. You know, we wanted it to be a cozy neighborhood restaurant where if it were, let's say, in our neighborhood and we didn't own it, a place that we just always wanted to go to. That's also really what the wine program tries to reflect, wines that we want to drink all the time. Same with the food, you know, it changes all the time, just to keep it super fresh so that people can come back over and over again and not feel like they're having the same thing all the time. That's it, you know, super cozy, warm, kind of dimly lit and you know, kind of also like prone to some debauchery, prone to some romance, you know, all the good things.
Look, I've had some some nights in Montreal winters at great restaurants. I know exactly what you're talking about. And listen, I will say it does have that neighborhood vibe, but few neighborhood restaurants are also the number one restaurant in Canada. How do you balance that, I would say, national spotlight, international spotlight? What was it like to get that sort of accolade, but knowing like that accolades come and go?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think one thing is for sure, when we got that mention, first, we were obviously surprised, super grateful, obviously, as well, you know. But I was really happy personally to have had the experience that I had under my belt at that moment in particular. Just because, like you said, accolades come and go, and it's really easy to kind of just get caught up. We just decided, you know what, we're so happy to that this is kind of just a proof of, in a way, that, you know, this restaurant's made some people really happy. Awesome. But we really worked hard at changing nothing. And we really worked hard at, my number one job from that moment became making sure that all of the people we love who have come to the restaurant for years supported us. The people who during COVID were getting like takeout boxes, the people whose kids come for ice cream in the summer, the people who come every year on their anniversary, on their birthday, whatever it is, all those people, I wanted to make sure that those people were still able to always come to the restaurant because it's a neighborhood restaurant, because that's the whole essence of it. So my number one job became that, you know, just really making sure that people were able to come no matter what. So obviously we want to remain a discovery. We want to remain a destination. That is something so special about that. We love that energy. So it's a mix. It's a mix of all those things. But yeah, that the experience that we have working, you know, in other kind of high profile places that have lots of demand and lots of articles coming out all the time, it really benefited us, I think, because we were able to kind of keep it cool headed, be grateful. The team was really happy. And we'll see, you know, next year someone else will be on top of that list. We'll be so happy for them. Yeah. And, you know, we'll move on.
No, I agree. We're not aiming for like a what's legacy to say. Like, we're not going for like a 5 year streak here. That's not the point. I was really happy and really surprised. You know, we're like a bistro that cooks like delicious, honest food. You know, we're not like fancy, I guess, ish, and the look of the place, whatever, but the food we make, you know, I love making bolognese and ragu and pappardelle and things that is very non-tweezery, you know? So in my head, those kind of lists and those top spots were always reserved for these like Nordic minimalistic tweezery restaurants, which were not. And so it came a bit as a shock, but at the same time, you know, you take the accolade, you know, it comes and go. We know really well we won't be there next year. So we're enjoying the ride for the moment. And
you know what? Also, though, I will say the list was kind of, to me, like a bit, not to like play down what we do, but it was a bit of a reflection of like an economic like moment, you know?
How could it not be? How could it not be? Yeah.
And like, and also what people are looking for when they are going out and spending some of their money, like maybe they're looking for really being able to identify what they're paying for, you know, paying for the white gloves and the valet service or whatever, you know, whatever else more luxurious places offer, which, you know, is such a treat and wonderful, but we clearly aren't that. So to me, it was kind of just like an indicator of, okay, this is what people are gravitating towards right now. This is what they're craving. This is what resonates. So it was interesting, you know, it's a moment in time in food and in restaurants today.
Amazing.
Well, listen, like the Montreal Canadiens made it to the final during the bubble year, the NHL. And like, it wasn't supposed to go like that. That's how I feel about art. It's like the fluke year.
No. So listen, I know we're getting close to the end, but I want you to paint me a picture. It's Tuesday night. Let's say 9:45, 10 p.m. Place is packed. What's the vibe? What's on the stereo? What's the scene like in the restaurant?
Okay, good. I love it. 9:45, people are still coming in. We take reservations until 10:30.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still some hustle and bustle at the door. Obviously, it's dark out. Obviously, the lights are super dimmed. Yeah. There's tons of food coming out at the pass, so it smells great.
If it's 9:45, we're probably a bit behind on the flip, so there's probably waiting standing next to the kitchen, which is kind of fun too.
People are having apéro, standing around, having a cocktail, a bottle of wine, a bottle of bubbles, whatever it is. And then music is getting a little bit soulful, maybe a little bit funky.
Alex Landry is in charge of the playlist, of like making the playlist at the restaurant, and he's really like, he has a band, Grand Public, which is amazing, and he will stop anything during service to like get the mood and change the music.
Yeah,
like that's the beginning of service playlist right now, and like I would be ringing the bell in the kitchen, like pick like service. And then this guy's like, wait a second, changing the music. I'll be back, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the music's super important and it's not loud, but it's definitely not loud. I don't know. I at that hour, maybe some Freddie Mercury, maybe woven in with like a bit of jazz, not too much. Like we love Keith Jarrett and things that are a little impro based.
BB Flash.
Yeah, there might be some Sade woven in. There might be a bit of rap like Dave or Sampa the Great or something like that. Kendrick Lamar.
Pino, our boy Pino.
And we love playing Alex's music too. Grand Public is dope, so there's always a bit of that. Yeah, that's it.
Amazing. Well, listen, congratulations to you both. If people want to stop by or make a reservation or just follow along, where can they go? Well, how can they check out what you're doing?
Yeah, thank you. That we always forget to mention that. VinMonLapin.com is the website. It's where you can find us. We also have an Instagram page, VinMonLapin, VinMonLapin.
Resi, Montreal, walk in, come see us. You know,
give us a call.
There's no room. We'll make you stand by the kitchen.
And there's some, if you need some shopping for the holidays, there's some good merch going on right now in the store as well.
Get the merch.
All right. Well, listen, so good to see you both. Congratulations on everything. I can't wait to come back. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance from Sonder Urians here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Sonder, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Pleasure to have you. Thanks for making time during the busy holiday season. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Coming off Thanksgiving week, how'd you spend it? Full of food, full of family, friends, or
yes.
a little bit more? Yeah, what'd you eat? What'd you get down?
I went the table? To my family lives on Whidbey Island, Washington, so and I'm in LA, so it's a pretty quick flight up there, and went up there. And my brother's a chef, and he did a couple turkeys on an open fire spit.
Casual, just a casual Francis Mauman style spit roasted turkeys, right?
Exactly.
Wow, that sounds so nice.
It was great. I mean, that place is paradise. I mean, it's pretty dark and rainy and most of the year, but still, it's incredible.
Yeah, well, when the light shines, it really shines, right?
Yeah, no, incredible. It's amazing.
Congratulations, sophomore record, Phantom Limb.
Thank you.
Listening to it over the break, and really nice for this time of year. How's it feel to have, I mean, you have a lot of work out in the world, but let's call this your second baby. What's it like to
have, it really is. I mean,
kid number two out there trotting around.
It's great. You know, I have, you know, I started my kind of music career, I guess, as a performing musician, and kind of, you know, drifted into film scoring with Danny, my partner, and we just became, you know, we never really sought it out. We became so busy, and it takes up a lot of my time. But I still have the urge, and I need to write songs and do other things. So it's hard to find the time, but I do, and it feels good to be able to put that out. It's pretty scary for me. Yeah. Just because, it's been years and years and years of kind of just sitting here by myself in my studio and writing film music, and putting my own stuff out is a little freaky.
Well, also, and you're such a well-accomplished composer with, Ozark and the new Tina documentary and things like that. And I'm not saying you're not hiding behind it, because like obviously the music's such a part of it, but like this is very much you.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think it's inaccurate to say we hide a little bit behind the film. I mean, it's maybe not in a bad way hiding.
No.
It's kind of camouflaging us as an ego. But yeah, this is all me. It is.
And it's interesting because, with so much work and so much creative output, okay, you put out the one album just to get the sketches or the creative things, you do it. But this is album number two. When did you start to realize that you had enough to say with the second release? And did you want to say something different? Because I know that you put this album out on your own imprint. So what was your thinking behind this one and how you wanted to share it with the world?
Well, Beasts was the first album that was released in 2020. And that was a collection of songs and pieces of music that I had been writing, I think, 8 years or something.
Right. Like all the things rolling around for years.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it took, to get it out to find, I put it out with Decca, and that was great. Yeah. But it took a while to get all that rolling. And all through that time, I was continuing to write songs and write music. So this album is, stuff that was, it's kind of been seamless, It wasn't like I finished that album and then I was like, I'm going to write this other album. Mm-hmm. It just kind of spilled over, and I just kept writing songs. And when I could, I'd, come back to them. And then as far as the label and getting it out, I've always, I find, the music industry and the way people listen to music has changed so much.
I mean, it's and night and day.
I'm not sure I can keep up, honestly. And that's okay. And I think what's most important for me is to just be putting this stuff out somehow and making sure it has some wings, that I'm not just kind of, putting it out totally under the radar. And so I always thought it would be cool to have some sort of conduit to release stuff, whether it's my record or Danny's record or our soundtrack. Sometimes we get to keep the soundtrack rights and we have publishing and masters. Sometimes we don't. So just having, you know, so we started this little label called Ghost Talk, and it's, you know, it's kind of stumbling along in its first few months of life, but hopefully it'll turn into something interesting. We're going to do, aside from our own non-film music, we're going to try and do kind of re-releases of you know, vinyl, you know, re-releases of scores that may be already out there or stuff that never got released.
I love that. I love that idea of just here's a label that you can curate, and sometimes it's things you love and sometimes it's your own stuff. I mean, there's so much great music, especially now, just stuff out there that is like, have you heard this?
Yeah.
You haven't, because you can't find it. Well, let's put it in your hands. You know, let's put it in that, and like classic soundtracks and inspirations. It's like,
Totally.
It's so much more of like an art project than going through like the red tape of like finding the label and going through that. And like, it allows different ways of expression, I imagine.
It really does. And I'm excited. Like, just like you said, it's a way of curating almost, you know, not just our stuff. Eventually we do other people's stuff too. And just having some sort of place where people can go and know, you know, I don't find good music.
Yeah.
Oh, and just, the vinyl aspect of it really excites me. I think, you know, people are getting back into vinyl, which is so cool. And the, you know, just the artwork and packaging and stuff that I love. I love all that. I
mean, the absolute really like ephemera obsession of vinyl these days is crazy.
It's great. It's great.
All right, let's get into a song. The first song I think you're going to play for us is Little Lie. What's the story behind it?
Well, this I re-recorded for you guys just with Danny on cello and me on acoustic guitar. It's the first track on the new album.
It's a great way to open up the album, and I'm glad it's the first song we're going to hear today. Here we go on Snacky Tunes live on Heritage Radio Network.
Told him just a little lie,
just a little lie.
Ooh, thought I had it right,
thought I had it right.
I swear it, I thought I had it right.
Trying, the lie become the truth I'm searching.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Sonder Urians, and there is this theme of, or this feeling of chaos, especially in that track. And I remember the first time I listened to it, and I was like, is this thing going to break open? And it was like pulling me forward and pushing me back, and then you bring it back in. Obviously, there's been a lot of chaos recently in the world and things like that. Was that an intentional inspiration to have that feeling in your music, or did it just subconsciously come through?
It might be subconscious. I think, I didn't intentionally. I don't think, there's no intentional comment on kind of what's going on in the world or anything, but it's funny you say that. But I always kind of, I have a real interest in chaos and mistakes, I guess. I mean, I always, with film music and with my own music, I'm always, looking for mistakes. I'm good at playing some instruments and not good at playing other ones, but I play them anyways, and I kind of welcome the chaos that ensues with that. That song has a few kind of cliffs where it, you get to an edge and it starts to fall off, and then it kind of comes back. Just kind of that kind of stuff happens in my recording process, I think. And I usually just kind of keep it rather than trying to edit it out or something.
I mean, it's nice. And, I'm staring at the studio you're in right now. And speaking of instruments, I see like, giant piano, a giant keyboard. And it seems to be such a driving sound and center of the album. Obviously, you work with so many different instruments. Why focus on the piano this time? Is it the range? Is it allow for those mistakes, those mishit keys, more than something that's a little bit more tuned in?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what's happened, I'm originally a guitar player.
Yeah.
And I, when I started working on film music, I started playing less and less guitar. There's just not as much room for it.
Sure.
And I was a terrible piano player. Still, I'm not great, but in my early 30s, I started taking lessons because I found myself writing on piano all the time, just kind of picking, note by note, going through, and I was like, I need to learn how to do this, and so I took lessons from a teacher when I was living in Brooklyn, and I really, I really took it seriously, and it was my morning routine to come in. The first thing I would do is play piano for an hour, practice classical pieces, scales, all that stuff. And so I've gotten, competent. I wouldn't say I'm great, but I play it in a weird way. I play it kind of like I would play the guitar. I don't know why. Like some of the
interesting
arpeggiations I do, which is kind of when you take apart chords.
Do
it like I do finger picking, same kind of rhythms and stuff. But I just find that the piano has, there's so much range, obviously, and there's so much power in it. And you can, with being able to voice chords and stuff, it's just something about it makes, it's not that it makes sense to me, it's that it doesn't make sense to me. So I don't look for it. The guitar I know so well, and I know the chord voicings, and I know the notes are and stuff. And piano, I know those notes, the white keys and black keys and whatever, but I end up not doing anything that I don't know what I'm doing. So I make mistakes more often, which
I never thought about that, about knowing instrument so well that it's confining.
Yes,
because the muscle memory and just knowing like this won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
I just never thought about the idea of attacking something and using it as a central inspiration because you're less familiar with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost for me, with all of the instruments I play, I don't really know what I'm doing. And that to me is the most freeing thing.
All right, let's get into the next song. I believe An Idea is what you have for us next.
Yeah, An Idea is the second song on Phantom Limb, and it's I rearranged it for this Mellotron over here, and I can't remember what else I put on Mellotron and some other stuff.
Amazing. Well, here we go. An idea from Sander Urians live on Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Sander Urians, who's sharing tracks off his second album, Phantom Limb. And, you know, I lived in New York for about 10 years, and now I've been in LA getting close to almost about the same time. And I'm always always interested when someone enters a New York or LA song into like the canon of songs about the cities. And look, it's a decades old, more than that, tradition. And you've made your entry. why now? And it's definitely a specific take on the city from the lyrics, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote Los, it's actually Los Angeles. So it's supposed to be the angel of Los Angeles, obviously. But it, I wrote that right as I realized I was moving here, kind of. I mean, my wife and I had kind of made the decision. And, you know, I was coming to LA a lot. I lived in New York for 20 years, and I come to LA a lot for work and for visit friends and touring and stuff. And I know the city, but I didn't really know it. I mean, I think I didn't really know it until I knew I was coming here. And then I came with a different view of it. And
I can relate. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was, you know, I was just continually, I love being in LA. My main part of being in LA, the part that I love is the accessibility of the mountains and nature and having a yard and being able to have a dog and all those things. It's not necessarily the city, you know, that I miss New York in that respect. The city of New York is unbeatable, I think, as a city.
Agreed. And
I was just, you know, I was shocked by a lot of stuff in LA. You know, this song is kind of it's not meant to be like a serious social commentary or anything. I don't really like getting into that, but it's just an observation of this kind of duality and, you know, like of these kind of gods that live in the mountains, kind of watching over this city that in parts is just falling apart and completely squalid. And it's so crazy to actually think about. For me, I'm just like, wow, this is what a strange
duality.
You know, what a weird situation you have here. Mm. So it was just, you know, and there was a lot of stuff coming out in the news of scandals and stuff. And I just felt this kind of, I don't know why I don't usually write songs like that kind of go into the you know, social commentary-ish world. But it just, I don't know, it hit me. It was probably the, you know, knowing that I was coming here and knowing I was about to be kind of part of this strange world.
Sort of being like to all your New York friends, it's like, I'm moving to LA, but I know what the score is. I know.
Yeah, exactly. That place is fucked up.
Yeah. Don't worry, guys. Don't worry. I still know where the best pizza is.
Right.
You know, going back to your writing approach, and so much of the work you do in movies and you know, prestige TV, you have these themes, musical, lyrical, things like that, that come throughout seasons and things like that. Do you apply that same approach of themes and ideas and music to when you're writing your own music? Is there room for that?
You mean an overall, you know, across the album kind of?
Like referencing different parts of songs, or is it more a compilation?
I think it's more a compilation. I would, you know, it's funny because when I started, I think the first song that I started working on from this record after the last one, I was kind of like, after I sort of finished the last one, was Eyes of Fire, which is kind of this epic, like, I don't know, rock, weird, psychedelic thing. And the idea was to, I was like, I want to just write a 40-minute song that just goes wherever I feel like it should go in the moment. You know, like I come in, I write a section and then come in a few days later, write another section that comes out of it.
And then, corpse pose type of thing, like just keep going. Yeah.
Exactly. And that was kind of the idea. I still want to do something like that. It didn't work out for that one, but
sure.
I think it's something I'd like to do. This idea of kind of having a more, maybe not a concept album or some kind of thematic through line of an album. But I don't think this one has it. There's too much time in between writing the songs. Yeah. It's just they're too they fit together in a weird way somehow, but they're written in different mind states, I guess.
No, that makes sense. I mean, listen, that's the third album's historically the concept album. So
great. That's great to know.
So right? There you go. Well, listen, I know that I want to get one more song in, but you know, we just finished one holiday. We're heading to the next holiday. What do you got planned? Are you doing the cooking this time, or is that all, you know, I guess if I had a chef with an open fire skills, I'd probably be flying too.
Well, my wife is from Argentina, and so we go there. We try to go there at Christmas every year, and we're going this year. So I'll probably eat some excellent steak. And yeah, I'll be down there. It'll be hot summer, and and that'll be fun.
Beautiful. Well, listen, congratulations on Phantom Limb. I believe the last track you have for us is Everything Shines. Yep. And it's out on Ghost Talk Records, your own imprint. What's the story behind this song?
This is a song, another song on the record. The original recording is all body sounds. It's all voices, clapping, you know, chest thumping, whistling. But obviously I couldn't do that in a more live setting, so I did it for guitar, cello, and vocals.
Beautiful. Well, congratulations. Thank you so much for making the time. Thank you to Gio for setting this up. And we'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
It's a ritual, it's a sacrifice. Behind the veil, illusion of light. Minds bleed with the sharpest lies.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.